Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals, 3 o'clock docket. Your panel is to my right, Justice Bob McCoy, to my left, Justice Hello. Bill Meyer. I know the weather's been a problem. Did y'all have any trouble making it from the west? Because Wise County was reporting 65 mile an hour winds. Okay, well, good. And David, how, the kidney stones, all gone? Still there, okay. Well, if we get any sirens, I have instructions for your safety, and I will read them at the appropriate time. I don't think there's going to be a problem. David, if you have a medical emergency, just let us know, and if y'all have any, get word of any problems that you need to rush out. It's just an unusual day, and we are aware of it. So, all right, I understand both sides are ready. Okay, would you call the case, please?
The court will now call Craig Earl Ingerson from the University of the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. David L. Richards will argue for the appellant. Mr. Robert Christian will argue for the state.
Okay, David.
May it please the court, Ms. Chalifo and Mr. Christian. Two women were murdered in a parking lot of a restaurant in Granbury. They were shot with a 38 caliber revolver from fairly close distance while they were parked in a car. Their bodies were found in the morning of June the 28th of 2008. And the medical examiner determined that they couldn't have died more than past 2 a.m. that morning. But by all accounts, it is believed that they died just around midnight in the parking lot. No question but that it was a murder. But the question is, who done it? Mr. Ingerson was one of several people that fell under suspicion during the investigation. Ultimately, he was indicted by the grand jury and he was tried by Mr. Christian. I have presented 4 points on appeal, which break down into really three areas. One is a sufficiency of the evidence argument. The second, it deals with the improper admission of an extraneous offense. And the final point, which is actually point four, deals with the improper exclusion of evidence. So this case kind of runs the gamut of the kind of issues that are presented to this court in criminal cases. On the sufficiency of the evidence argument, I talked with Mr. Christian yesterday and let him know that I always kind of believe that sufficiency arguments before appellate courts are better left to the briefs and not oral argument, because we tend to turn them into jury arguments. So I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to focus on my sufficiency complaint, except to the extent that there is an issue concerning a weapon that Mr. Ingerson had purchased back in 1999, which kind of plays into the state's theory of the case. I'm instead going to concentrate on the admission of an extraneous bad act by the trial court that we don't believe was probative to any issue in the case, and that even if it was probative, that the potential for prejudice far outweighed any probative value. And that issue concerns the purchase of a revolver back in 1999. Now, I want to make it clear that revolver was never connected to this offense. The gun was never recovered, and ballistic tests were done on the gun that was purchased, because the previous owner of the gun was a gentleman in Indiana who said he took all of his guns out and shot them all at this big dirt pile he had in back, which would have included this .38 caliber revolver that Mr. Ingerson purchased. Well, they dug out all of those bullets and tried to do a match. None of them came back as the bullets that were found in the bodies of these two young women. So the gun was never linked to this shooting. It served the purpose of showing he did own a .38 caliber revolver among many other guns that he had purchased in the past. But it really wasn't probative beyond that. Now,
and the MEU's report was clear that it was a .38.
Yes, I think it was a .38 caliber revolver, and they knew from the lands and grooves and all of the CSI stuff they do that it was a revolver that fired the shots. But you know, it's common knowledge there are revolvers. Within a mile of this courthouse, there's probably a .38 caliber revolver. They seem to be everywhere. So,
well, let's just assume for a minute that you're right. Now what?
Now the second step would be, and I think that's undisputed. I think the second step would be taking a look at the check and why it was admitted and why it constituted an extraneous offense. Mr. Ingerson was not supposed to be purchasing weapons when he bought that. So the fact that he bought a .38 caliber revolver is, and I admit, can be relevant, and I think that was admissible. Matter of fact, the trial attorney said this negotiable instrument that he presented, yes, it would be admissible, except it's more than a negotiable instrument, which you've got here. What you've got here is an attempt to cover up the purchase of the weapon. Now, this weapon was purchased in 1999. At the very bottom of the check, the part that a lot of people overlook when they're writing a check is the little memo part of the check. And on the memo part of this check, States Exhibit 17 shows that Mr. Ingerson, when he bought that gun, tried to cover up its purchase by putting down there in the memo part, he bought it for doors, that the money was for doors, not a gun. Well, that was a bad act. It wasn't for doors. It was for a gun, the .38 caliber revolver. So when they went to introduce this check that contained this surplusage or extraneous material on its own, wasn't necessary for the check, defense attorney objected, you're trying to introduce an exhibit that has, yes, it does link appellant to the purchase, that's not a problem. The problem is the very bottom portion of this exhibit shows that Mr. Ingerson purchased it or was trying to cover up the purchase because he alleged that he'd purchased it. He was purchasing doors, not a gun. And that fact could not have escaped the jury's attention. So what defense counsel at trial said was, look, this thing is admissible at this, except this part at the bottom, because that constitutes a bad act. This gun was purchased in 1999 at a time when, before appellant's divorce and before he ever met either of these two women. Now later the evidence showed he did have a relationship, a kind of a strange relationship with this Robin Richter. He met her at the tax office in Hood County and they became friends. But as far as, you know, any connection that the gun was purchased to commit a murder, you know, it's just not there. The gun was purchased in 1999. So the state had a right to show that the gun was purchased. But what they didn't have a right to show that was that the defendant was a person of bad character because he illegally purchased the gun and tried to cover up his purchase with this lie on the memo part of the check. So what defense counsel said
was, Mr. Richards,
was,
why was the defendant, Mr. Ingersoll. Why Ingerson? Why was he not eligible to purchase a gun in 1999?
I believe that he violated federal law because of a prior incident involving a gun. He wasn't permitted to own a gun.
Was he a convicted felon?
I believe he was.
And therefore could not make a purchase.
He could not make a legal purchase of guns.
Okay.
So, you know, that is the bad act, and the fact that he lied when he purchased the gun.
Okay.
So, what we have is defense counsel at trial saying, "Look, this evidence would be admissible linking appellant to the purchase of the gun, except it contains this extraneous bad act. Redact it. Just take it out of the exhibit, and it's fine." And the judge said, no, comes in as the exhibit. My contention, appellant's contention on appeal is, that had no probative value at all, except to show that the defendant was a person of dishonest character. The very reason that you keep out extraneous offenses unless they've got some probative value. But even if it, and I don't know what probative value that part of the check had. And in the state's brief, now they wrote a very good brief, but I think when it comes to issues 2 and 3, this extraneous check issue, we're really talking past each other. The state is saying evidence that the defendant purchased a gun is admissible, a .38 caliber. But our argument is, yes, evidence that he purchased the gun was admissible, but evidence that when he purchased the gun, he told a big whopper, and that the jury knew he was telling a big whopper, he was lying about it back in 1999, that's what has no probative value, and I can't imagine what value that has, and any probative value is far outweighed by the potential for prejudice, because the whole state's theory turned on appellant who denied the offense being a liar. He's not telling the truth. Their theory, and they weren't required, of course, to show motive. You're not required to do that. But they had a very weak circumstantial evidence case, so they were throwing everything against the wall. And the motive that they came up with, and Mr. Christian, I think I'm quoting him directly, was that Robin Richter, one of the victims, was, quote, basically shaking him down for money. In other words, she was using her relationship, which teasing him that it was going to be a sexual relationship, in return for money. Well, that theory is not supported by any evidence in the case. His bank accounts don't show that he was giving her money. So it's a very weak circumstantial evidence case. Now, I know circumstantial evidence is sufficient alone. There's no direct evidence in this case. Circumstantial evidence alone is sufficient to convict someone of a charged offense, but you have to be real careful. The cases that are reversed for insufficient evidence all tend to be cases that are circumstantial evidence cases, and the evidence is weak. And what we have here is weak evidence. We have the defendant. Yes, he met Miss Richter and her friend, Miss Ferris, at this Japanese restaurant where they had drinks. And according to the witnesses, the women were showing interest in other men. There were other things going on, you know, typical bar scene. They left at separate times, but he was in the parking lot at one point talking to both women standing near the car. Now,
Mr. Richard, let's assume once again that you're correct. Okay, so we have one piece of evidence that had some probative value, but we had that one piece of evidence has some prejudicial value, which your position is was greater than the probative. Okay, you're correct. Okay. Where does that leave us?
It leaves us reversing the case with instructions, I guess, or the opinion written in such a manner as the trial court understands shouldn't have introduced that evidence. And on retrial, you know, they're free to you know, bring whatever evidence, including any additional evidence they have. But that check, the introduction of that check, was improper, constituted error, had a strong potential for harm, such that this court should conclude that it doesn't have confidence in the verdict to reverse.
So, I mean, your position is that we have one piece of evidence whose prejudicial value outweighs the probative value, and that calls for a reversal?
Yes.
Okay. Under what standard? Or
it's, Judge, it's an abuse of discretion standard on both issues 2, 3, and 4 in this case. So really it's, the argument is that the trial court abused, Judge Walton abused his discretion when he overruled defense counsel's objection and when he overruled defense counsel's request that this evidence is admissible if that portion of the exhibit is redacted. There's no reason why that shouldn't have been redacted. There is absolutely no reason.
Okay. I don't want to put words in Judge McCoy's mouth, but it's the non-constitutional standard, right?
It is non-constitutional standard.
How, can you explain to us how that one
That's
word,
exactly where I'm going.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Satisfies the non-constitutional standard requiring reversal. Because the check is admissible except for the one word doors, right?
Yes.
In your opinion?
Yes.
So how does that satisfy the non-constitutional standard for reversal?
Well, Judge, I guess if I need to, I can send a letter brief, but...
No, just tell us.
Well, Judge, the cases that are reversed, and there are a lot of cases that have been reversed for the improper admission of extraneous evidence, I think many of them are of the similar type of potential for prejudice that would require this court to reverse the case.
Are you saying it undermines confidence in the verdict?
Yes.
Because the jury convicted him as a criminal in general, or just
yes.
for being...
Could have. I mean, it was a skunk in the jury box, I guess is the old-time lawyers describe it. It was a skunk in the jury box and requires reversal under the standard for non-constitutional error. And there are a lot of cases out there that, you know, whether it's, 81B2 or the 42, Article 42 now, the improper admission of extraneous offenses that undermines an appellate court's confidence in the trial court's verdict requires this court to reverse.
Mr. Richards, I know your light is off, but I haven't had a chance to ask you a question. I do want to ask you one rather broad question. Other than this evidence about what was written in the memo portion of the check that was used to buy a weapon, a .38 caliber revolver in 1999, which did not link up by the ballistics testing to the incident, what else was in evidence that indicated any bad character action or bad character or bad acts on the part of Mr. Ingerson?
Well, Judge, there were some, but I think that it was properly admitted. Some of the bad acts were that he had chastised Ms. Richter in the restaurant. There was a bad act that he
chastised, that, loud talking.
Yes. He was criticizing her for she allegedly, for example, grabbed the crotch of someone else in the bar.
I saw that, but I'm talking about a bad act.
Well,
in terms of a crime.
Oh, there weren't any crimes. I mean, that
inappropriate conduct is a little different than a bad act to me.
Well, no, yes, but if you look at the statute, it doesn't say it's got to be a crime. It can be a bad act. And, you know,
acts all depends upon each one of us in arriving at a conclusion about whether the conduct was such an offensive activity
yes.
that it could be a bad act. As
Correct.
Opposed to an inappropriate conduct.
Yes, Yes, Your Honor, it's kind of all in the, you know, it's a subjective determination, but there was no objection to any of the evidence concerning Mr. Ingerson's conduct other than this, which I thought raised to an error of.
All right. Thank you very much.
David, how much did the jury know about why he couldn't buy a gun, why he would put doors there?
The jury was aware of that. Now, it wasn't stressed, admittedly, by the state during jury argument, but that check was critical to the state's case. Even in the state's brief, they say, and I'm quoting on from page 14, because the check connected appellant to the murder weapon, the trial court didn't abuse its discretion. Well, it
well,
didn't
wasn't the murder weapon.
The murder weapon was a .38 caliber revolver, but it wasn't this .38 caliber revolver. So
could you briefly talk about your fourth point?
Yes, Your Honor. That was the improper exclusion of evidence that there was another gentleman who could have been involved, and the trial court cut off defense counsel from raising that issue in front of the jury.
Don't you need to? I read what you're at point. I'm hearing you, but don't you need more than motive? I mean, it seemed to me what I read was that there was a motivation out there that possibly another individual could have committed this.
Yes.
But I didn't see anything past motive or possible motive. I didn't see evidence that it occurred. And don't you need that?
Well, I think there's no doubt. Yes, Your Honor, you do need that. But there was evidence that she was in, I guess, a deeper relationship with this other gentleman, Mr. Sulla, who was a suspect in the case. He was investigated. Now, he was ruled out by the police, along with some other people who they initially suspected and investigated. But he was in a relationship with her. At least there are text messages going back and forth in which she's implying that that there's something sexual going on between them. And so there was a connection between Ms. Richter and this evidence of this person that didn't come in. And there, you know, was some evidence. Now, what they said was they stopped the investigation. They had investigated or were in the process when she was killed of investigating her for improperly, I guess, embezzling, what the word would be, money. Now, she may have been completely innocent of that, and we have to assume she was innocent, but at least there was an investigation going on. And she was in this relationship with this other gentleman who was a suspect, and the jury didn't get to hear about him and didn't get to hear about that relationship. Matter of fact, I think that evening she, in fact, told people that that she wanted him sexually and was sending sexually explicit text messages to him.
The other fellow.
Yes. So I think, you know, it's one of those, you know, issues where it's an abuse of discretion standard, but the general rule is anything relevant in establishing a defense, and in this case somebody else could have done it defense, is normally admissible. And, you know, the fact that that evidence would have taken, you know, a couple of hours to develop, I think is insufficient reason to speed the trial up. To keep that evidence out. It does complicate things every time you present a defense where you have the jury going in a different direction potentially than the kind of linear progression of the state's case. But you know, that's why we have trials, and that's why the defense gets to call witnesses. And in this case, we believe they were improperly excluded from exploring a potential defense.
Thank you, Mr. Richards.
You. Anybody else have any questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Richards.
Thanks. Robert, you look like you've got something to say.
You might want to give him a little more
We're not going to cut you off, so you tell you say whatever you need to say.
Well, good afternoon. First thing I'll say, it's a little intimidating to argue a case against a former justice of this court, but I do have one advantage over Mr. Richards in this respect, and sometimes it's a disadvantage when I'm up here answering for the crazy things the prosecutor did in the trial, in that I'm the one that tried the case. But I have an advantage in the sense that I lived this case for a couple of years, and I want to clear up a couple of things about this gun and some facts about it. In Texas, a lot of us have guns, we use guns, we watch CSI, and I think we are quasi-experts in tool marks and identification and that sort of thing. But my office and the Granbury Police Department learned something in this case, and I think it explains some of the misconceptions about whether or not this weapon was matched up or what have you. And that is, there are class characteristics for firearms. And a class characteristic is the caliber of the firearm, you know, how big the hole is, how many lands and grooves are in the rifling, whether they turn left or whether they turn right. You also have individual characteristics. And individual characteristics are imperfections that may be imparted to the barrel during manufacturing, onto the breech face of the gun. And the family characteristics never change. You know, a .22 rifle is always going to be a .22 caliber gun. It's never going to be a .270. But the individual characteristics can change, and they do change.
So you're saying the lands and grooves matched, they were right or left, same distance, same everything. Everything matched up, but some of the individual characteristics had changed.
Actually, no.
No, they hadn't.
It gets complicated in this respect. And I'll just kind of start kind of from the beginning. And where this happened, we had a bullet. We had no shell casings. The investigators thought they were looking for a revolver. And they find this bullet. They talk to a guy at DPS, and he asks, how big is the bullet? They measure it. And he says, well, do the grooves go left or do they go right? And the investigator says, well, the grooves go to the left. And the expert said, you are looking for a Colt, 38 Special or 357 Magnum revolver, because all the other major manufacturers of revolvers have the twist go the other way. Smith & Wesson, Ruger, Rossi, Taurus, all of them. So now they're looking for these particular class characteristics. On this issue with the berm, the reason why that's important, they did go up to Indiana where this gun was fired, and they pulled a bunch of bullets out, and they analyzed all of them and looked at them. But none of the bullets in that berm matched the class or family characteristics of a Colt 38 Special or 357 Magnum revolver.
Colts turn which way?
Left, I think.
And there was none in this pile that turned to the left?
No. So we know that no Colt 38 Special or 357 Magnum revolver was ever fired into that berm. So the officers went up there, and that was one of the strengths of the case. They ran down every single possible thing. They went up there. They dug up this whole berm looking for it. They didn't find anything, but they did not find bullets that matched the class characteristics. So we know it's not that this gun was excluded. We know that a Colt was never fired into the berm, or at least they didn't find a bullet that was fired from a Colt 38 Special or 357 Magnum into that berm. Okay. So it is kind of confusing when you think about this, because I will tell you, I assumed that if I have a bullet and I have a gun, that certain things could be done. But we learned in this case that that's not necessarily the case. I can fire a weapon, get certain class individual characteristics from that bullet, fire the gun a second time, and just the fact of the violence of that bullet going through the barrel can change those individual characteristics from bullet to bullet. So it's interesting, but it's just not accurate to say that this Colt that was purchased with the Dorr deal, this Colt was excluded as a murder weapon because it was not.
And it wasn't connected as being the murder weapon either, was it?
It was not. And I want to talk a little bit about kind of the chronology of how that happened, and a little bit, this might be a little bit outside the record, but it might explain kind of what was going on.
Well, let me ask this before you down the next trail. What you just told us was is that the gun that was subject of the check that had the door written on the four line was not the gun that was from which the bullet came that you found in the car or around the car.
No, I'm not saying that.
You're not saying that.
I'm saying that it just happened to be a Colt 38 Special, a Colt revolver with a left-hand twist, the right lands and grooves, and that we know that the one of the bullets, we only recovered one, but the one bullet with the victim's DNA on it was fired from a Colt 357 Magnum or 38 Special revolver, a Colt.
But I thought that the gun that was fired into the berm was the one that was the subject of the check, and the gentleman said that he fired all of his guns into the berm. So that means either he did not sell that gun that was the subject of the check, or you did not find a bullet from the gun in the berm. Or am I missing something?
That's true. I would say the second part is true. They probably didn't find it. It was 10 years prior that the gun was fired. And so I think, you know, either he hit it in the berm and it bounced off and ricocheted or they didn't find it. But you're right.
Okay.
On this issue with the gun, they're looking for a Colt 38 Special 357 Magnum revolver. They go to the defendant and they ask him, can we see your guns? And he shows them lots of guns, many of them Colts, but not a 38 and not a 357 Magnum revolver. They ask him, have you ever owned one? He says, no. And this is the part that's a little bit outside the record, but I think it explains kind of what actually was going on. It took 18 months for the indictment to happen in this case, and the detective found out that the defendant was convicted of theft, embezzlement, I'm not sure what they called it in Indiana, many years ago. And just to have something to do, he got that case and started looking at it. And in that case, he found this piece of paper with a check. And it said, I don't know how much the check was written for, memo says door, and underneath the check, it's a photocopy of a check with a statement below it. There's a notation. I got this check and sold a Colt pistol to Fred Ingerson. So the investigator thinks, okay, well, this could be the Colt that we're looking for. And so they go back to this guy that got the check, and they went back to
which the, part of this is not in the record, Mr.
Just this the part about how he found it. How he found this piece of paper.
The piece of paper's in the record.
But the piece of paper's in the record, but how the officer found it is not. So he goes back, and he talks to this man, and he finds the serial number. He goes back to the guy he bought it from, the yellow sheet when you buy a gun, and you fill all that out from the license, the guy that the gun store. And so now they know that from this witness that Fred Ingerson purchased this Colt revolver, even though he said that he never had a revolver of that type. But this happened 10 years ago. And so the question becomes, we can't really say that the officer found this because the defendant's a convicted felon. So we just kind of call this James Elrod. And we say, did you sell a gun to Fred Ingerson 10 years ago? And you have to think about how much credibility this witness is going to have in front of a jury that he just remembers this gun purchase 10 years ago. We showed him the check. He says, yes, that's the check I got. And I think it also becomes a question, why would you keep a check? I mean, how many people out there have a check, a canceled check from 10 years ago? I mean, it seems kind of bizarre. I mean, I don't. I don't keep those things. And so the theory of admissibility was, the reason why we had the notation and all of it was to show, to first corroborate that this purchase was made, corroborate the testimony of this James Elrod, and to explain why these records were still in existence.
I thought you said the records were in the records of the previous case.
They were.
And so they were in existence because they were part of the records of a previous case.
But we couldn't go into, I mean, I didn't think. I thought it would be risky to explain to the jury that there even was a previous case.
So we just won't tell the jury that we found there was a previous.
In a different state.
In a different state.
We won't tell the jury that we found this records in a previous case in a different state. Instead, we'll just call Ingersoll and see if he's got a copy of the check.
Not Ingersoll.
I'm sorry. We'll call, what's his name?
Elrod.
We'll call Elrod and see if he's got a copy of this check that he got 10 years ago.
Right. Because
he did have?
Well, no. He didn't have. We got it. Elrod didn't have, but there's only one check.
Right.
But we didn't want to go into. The truth is, the reason why they had it is that he's a convicted felon and that he was investigated in Indiana. Didn't think that was a good thing to go into in front of the jury.
Okay. But the check, the copy of the check that was used when you talked to Mr. Elrod when he was being a witness was a copy that came from the previous conviction in the different state.
That previous investigation, yes.
All right.
And the notation was made in his handwriting.
So it wasn't like he called it. He had a check that he kept 10 years. It's just that he remembered about the check when he was showed the copy.
That's true. Okay. That's true. One thing that is not briefed in the brief, but I think it's important to say before I run out of time, is that I also...
You're going to run out of time.
Okay. Well, I'll slow down then.
Slow down.
The appellant...
Can you tell us where we're going here? I mean, we've been... I'm hearing the very interesting factual story. Where are we going? So I can kind of be connecting where we're going with what we're talking about.
Well, we're going as to why the state needed this evidence, State's Exhibit 17.
Okay.
But as a threshold matter, I'm going to say that I don't believe that the appellant has preserved the error for appellate review either. And I want to go through the record and explain that. State's Exhibit 17 was identified at page 152 in Volume 4, mainly to refresh the memory of another witness. And at that point, the defense counsel for the appellant says objection. That's all he says, is the word objection. And the lawyers approach the bench. And there's an off-the-record discussion there. And then with that witness, State's Exhibit 17 is never admitted. It's used to refresh the recollection of the witness. And then James Elrod is called. And right at the beginning of James Elrod's testimony, at page 158, I stand up and I say, Your Honor, pursuant to our bench conference, we need to take something up outside the presence of the jury. So the judge says, okay, the jury goes out. And at that point, we go through this... this evidence of, I met this guy, Fred Ingerson, and he said he wanted some guns, and I had this gun I didn't like, and so I went to him, and he gave me the gun, and it said that the check was for a door. I really didn't like that. Kind of made me a little uneasy, but I needed the money, and I had a gun I didn't want, wanted to get rid of it, so I took it anyway. And then weeks, days go by, and this guy from where he works says, hey, did you get a check from Powell Construction or whatever the company was? He says, yeah. Was it for a door? He says, no. And so he asked me to come to the lumber yard, and he asked me to write on the check what I bought with that check. And so I did, and I showed him. I says, is this what it is? He says, yeah, that's my handwriting and that I wrote underneath it, and that's the check I got, State's Exhibit 17. And outside the presence of the jury, the defense counsel objects, and the objection is, we'd object to the admission of that exhibit, Your Honor. It seeks to introduce extraneous conduct through the particularly crimes, wrongs, bad acts, or other acts that are alleged to have been committed by the defendant, which are generally excluded by the exclusionary rule. We would agree with the admission of the exhibit if the bottom half was redacted. As
what are you reading from? What page?
166, and that's the objection.
Which volume?
Four. And the court makes this ruling. All right, I will overrule your objection. I find the probative value to outweigh the prejudicial effect. I will allow that. But I will restrict that testimony with no reference being made to any criminal prosecution that arose out of the execution of the document. Do not testify about that in any respect. That's not relevant, you know, that you were prosecuted a convicted felon. One thing I'll also clear up. Before this point, Fred Ingerson was not a convicted felon, okay? He didn't have to hide this because he was a convicted felon. This was what made him a convicted felon, embezzling in the monkey business with his check. But anyway, and then the witness is further instructed by me. Do you understand that? Yes. If you think we're asking you about a conviction, we're not, okay? Don't say conviction unless the judge tells you to, all right? Okay. And so the jury comes back in. And then without objection, there's this testimony, and the defense counsel lets me lead some to make sure that we can control this witness and they didn't say anything he's not supposed to. You know, well, how much is a check for? Okay. So did you cash the check? Yes. And when you got the check, it looked like legit. It was legitimate. Yes, sir. Did you think it was good? Yes, sir. And in the memo, what did it say? It says for a door. Was a check for a door? No. What did you think about that? I didn't like it, but, you know, just kind of like I've told you, I needed the money, blah, blah, blah. And then at 1:75, after we go through this, and there's no objection to any of this testimony, a question answer, the state says, Your Honor, we offer State's Exhibit 17. Again, a photocopy of the check with this note written underneath it. And defense counsel, no objection. Court, State 17 is admitted. And so it's my contention that there's no error here. And in all fairness to defense counsel, I can't read his mind, but if you look at what could have gone on here, the defense counsel has gotten a lot of what he wanted. He's gotten it out that the defendant was convicted of a crime. He's kept it out that the defendant was ever investigated by the police, that he was ever arrested. You know, there could be a lot of reasons why a person would write something different on the memo. It could be he was writing a check for a gun to purchase for his wife and didn't want her to know what the present was, wanted it to be a surprise. I mean, there could be a lot of reasons why you would write that memo. And the jury was never told that there was an investigation, that there was any of that. And the defense counsel kept all that out. And so that's why I think he didn't object, because he got the relief he wanted. He got that instruction. And it was limited in that way.
So your position is that the bad act was merely writing door on the check when it was for a gun. And that
Yes.
was the extent of what the jury knew.
Yes.
That's your position. Okay.
And I don't think that there's anything in the record to suggest. I mean, this is not a deal where there was something out there in the record that the state didn't emphasize. Okay. There's nothing in the record other than just how you have summed it up. He wrote door on the memo when it was for a gun.
You said the monkey business with the check is what made him a convicted felon?
Yes. Well, this is not in the record, but he was stealing from his employer.
That check was written on an employer's account.
Yes.
And it was written by him for a personal purchase and indicating that it was of the type of purchase that would have been a proper purchase on the account if it really was for the business that he was working with.
I think all that's true. But none of that was really developed in the record. I mean, it wasn't developed that he worked for any of these people, or, I mean, we just stayed away from that in anticipation of this day, you know, and to answer these questions. You know, it really was not really germane
well,
to our case.
Well, if that's the case, Mr. Christian, why wouldn't you agree to redact the memo purchase portion that said doors, and instead insist that all of that check be put in evidence?
I don't know that I insisted that it be in there. And to answer your question, it happened kind of fast. Didn't really think about it. And when I offered it, the defense counsel didn't object, and it came in. I mean, if...
Was there any time whenever the issue of redaction was discussed with the trial court, the judge?
It happened very fast. The defense, I think the focus of the court, candidly, was on limiting this other stuff that was kind of relevant to this check thing, but probably prejudicial about him being a convicted felon
That. Now, I understand what you're saying. The defense counsel might have got maybe 3 or 4 bites at this apple and was really pleased that there wasn't more things thrown at the jury about bad conduct that might have been committed by Mr. Ingerson. But what I'm asking you is, as we went through here, Mr. Richards was emphasizing the fact that the check might have been proper evidence all the way through about a purchase of a 38 caliber revolver if you didn't have the memo portion in there. And so I thought what I was hearing him say is that the defense counsel at the trial court level said, let's redact this part, and then there's no objection.
He did say that, and that's true in the record. I think that it's fishy for the state to bring up a check that was written 10 years ago that the jury would think that Mr. Elrod just happened to have. I mean, I think the fact that it was somewhat fishy explains why the record existed in the first place.
I understand. Maybe somewhat fishy to go think about going digging out a berm that's got bullets in it that are 10 years old.
Well, it was a serious case in that regard. But I just don't, I mean, that was the key to the thrust of the defense argument here. This is a circumstantial case. You don't have a gun. Putting this gun in the defendant's hand after he repeatedly stated he never had it was important. And so that's why we felt like it was important to develop this and put not only just a .38 revolver, but a Colt .38 revolver when we know that it was a Colt .38 Special or .357 Magnum that was a murder weapon. I mean, well, why lie about that?
Circumstantial evidence that you told us you didn't ever have a Colt and the check showing that you made a purchase is connecting you to the state's theory of circumstantial evidence proof that you committed the murder.
Right. And that this gun that you're lying about that we know that you own because we had the yellow sheet from Elrod was a .38 Special Colt revolver.
But it didn't have the markings on it to show that it was the murder weapon.
We don't know. We never found it.
Bullets.
But the bullets in the berm, and this is important, and this is confusing. I mean, you got to think about it. But the bullets in the berm were not fired from a Colt .38. The ones that we found were not fired from a Colt .38 Special or .357 Magnum.
Yes, I've got that point. I understand that.
Okay.
You're back to then whether you believe, is his name Elrod?
Yes.
Whether you believe Mr. Elrod when he said, I fired all my guns into that berm.
Or that it could be a lot of things. It could be that they didn't find it. It could be that, I mean, this is something that happened 10 years ago. And if they had happened to find a bullet and that it matched, then that would have been great. But I just don't think that because they didn't find it means that this
what
wasn't a murder weapon.
What part of this business about a search of a berm 10 years old, 10 years an act that occurred 10 years before and firing a bullet into a berm was before the jury?
That was before the jury because the defense brought it out. You know, they were trying to make a similar point that is kind of raised in your question. I mean, this guy says that he fired the bullet in there, the gun in there, and you guys didn't find any.
Didn't find a connecting bullet.
Right. And the response to that was, well, you know, maybe we didn't find that particular one. I mean,
Christian, I would confess one thing to you, and that is that I was looking at the shuck in this case, and it's 9 folders. And I read some good parts of it, especially parts that were referenced in the briefs, and the references in the briefs were certain pages and certain volumes, and those are read. But I haven't read all 9 volumes of that record yet. And that's the reason I'm asking you some of these questions.
Right.
I didn't see anything in the part that I read about testimony about the firing of the bullets into the berm. That's obviously in another piece of the record I hadn't read yet.
I think that's going to be with Calvin's story when he talks about the analysis that he did.
All right.
And
thank
then also
you.
The ranger.
And, well, excuse me, I have a question. In the briefs, there's a, and again, I have not yet read the record. So the gun, was there a gun the gun that was seen under the seat of appellant's car?
Yes.
Was it ever actually recovered or looked at?
No.
So there's no evidence that it was a Colt. I would assume somebody just drew a picture of it and tried to match it up or?
Well, the what happened was the ranger went to the lube place and was trying to find out who changed the guy's oil and wanted to see if there was something fishy in the car, blood or something. And this young man volunteered, oh, yeah, you know, there's a revolver underneath there. And then he identified it as a gun that looked similar to, and there was a lot of dispute about his credibility, but the jury resolved those issues in the state's favor, evidently, identified it as looking like this Colt revolver that James Elrod sold the defendant 10 years prior. And there was also some other people that put that gun or a similar gun in his hand.
But it didn't match the revolver that Elrod had sold to
That is not true.
Well, it may not have dismatched it, but it didn't match it other than as to the general class characteristics.
There was no way we could have even compared the family, the individual characteristics, because we didn't have it to compare. It
didn't have the gun.
Right, but we matched the family characteristics of it, too.
Yeah, well, every Colt 38 Special is going to have the same family characteristics.
That's true.
Don't, please, no input from the gallery. So all you can say is 10 years or however many years before he bought a 38 Special and some 38 Special was used.
Right. And in and of itself, that's not that relevant. But then what becomes more telling in front of a jury is the fact that he's lying about it. You know, he's saying he never had this gun.
Then why did you object to the evidence that somebody else could have done it?
On the number four? Let's talk about that if we can. When you buy a car, you go to the tax office, you have to pay sales tax on it. But if I were to give you a car, you pay a $10 gift tax. So one way a clerk could steal would be if Rob Christian comes in, I bought this car from Bob McCoy, and I paid $10,000 for it, and here's I just have cash, I'm going to pay the sales tax, I leave, then the clerk could forge my name, fill out a form that says, oh, Bob McCoy gave me, you know, that car, and then purportedly give me a refund, but actually just pocket it. Kind of follow the scam that could happen.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, all this is all that they had in their bill was this, that Robin Richter, one of the victims, had some cash refunds, four of them, I believe, and that was suspicious. That Mohammed Silla had been to the tax office, and it was interesting. Their own witness says, is there anything to suggest, even if Robin Richter was doing something illegal, that this Silla guy was even involved in it? And the answer is, well, he's black. That and he was around, and maybe somebody's stealing, so he's black. It must be him. I mean, there was no, that was the extent of it. That was it. And they're just no relevance to that at all. I mean, there was, they didn't, it's not as if they brought people in to say, yeah, you know, I paid cash, I never got a refund. I mean, none of those people, all it was that it seemed suspicious that she had some of those refunds, more than usual. Four.
And so you're saying the only evidence appellant used to try to tie this other fellow to the murders was the fact that he had been in the tax office?
And that he was black.
Well, that's not,
Of course. I mean, I'm not trying to be flippant, but I mean, that was what it was. And the trial judge is just like you, I mean, listening to this and saying, well, you know, that's not anything. And that's the extent of this theory of this other motive thing. And then there's just nothing there at all.
Was there any kind of offer of proof that
yes
went beyond that?
No. No, that what I've told you is basically what it is. There's no evidence other than just suspicion. There was no evidence of any malfeasance on the part of Robin Richter. No evidence, if there was malfeasance, that Mohammed Silla was involved, other than that he saw her there and that he was black.
Well, the long and short of your argument is it's your position that there was not even a motive.
Correct.
In the evidence.
Yes. And, okay. And even in the bill, I even asked the witness, because it was also that Muhammad Silla sent his friends that needed tax work to Robin Richter. So there was some sort of scam here. And I asked him, well, if I wanted to steal from the government, all I got to do is go up there and lie when you sold me the car and say that you gave it to me, right? Then why would I have to pay you the money if you're the clerk or Robin Richter the money and then leave and then have her fill out this fraudulent application and then give me the money back? It just didn't make any sense at all. None. No sense. So it really has no probative value at all. Moving back, I just want to say about the harm issue on this points 2 and 3. I mean, that's not briefed in the appellant's brief. And in all fairness to the appellant, I mean, the argument would have to be that first it was preserved, and then it was error, and then if it was error, that it affected the substantial rights of the appellant. And, you know, I think this is boilerplate law, but as I've quoted it from a case, substantial rights are not affected by the erroneous admission of evidence if the appellate court, after examining the record as a whole, has fair assurance that the error did not influence the jury or had but a slight effect. And what the appellant would have to show harm here would be basically the jury's back in the jury room and they say, you know, the defendant is charged with a double capital murder, execution style killing, basically shot in the head. I don't think the state's proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But he wrote door on the memo of a check 10 years ago, so I'm going to find him guilty of capital murder and send him to prison for life anyway. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't really see how that argument can even be made in this case. I mean, it's not a violent crime, and I just don't see how they can show any harm at all in this
lying,
case.
Lying, you don't think would be a harm?
I'm sorry?
Committing a lie would not, I mean, perpetrating a lie and then testifying that you didn't do something. That's your credibility directly.
Well, I would answer that to say that I think we've all lied. I think all that the jury knows that every one of them has lied. And a lie told 10 years ago about what would be a collateral matter if they didn't believe that the state proved that the defendant committed this murder, it's just absolutely meaningless. That's not why the evidence was put in. And I just don't see how there's harm there. Would respond that I don't think that a lie 10 years ago is that big a deal, especially about purchasing a gun versus a door.
Any other questions? Any other questions? Rob, anything else you want to say?
No. Thank you for all the extra time, and I think we've talked through the bad weather. So I again, thank you. And if you don't have any other questions, I'll sit down.
Okay. David, any rebuttal?
Yes, very short. Very, very short. Just really two things, judges. First of all, with respect to the waiver argument, that is an argument that I've heard for the first time here. It wasn't in the state's brief. And I'm not criticizing them for realizing it at the time of argument, but I would like the opportunity to have a short letter brief to the court in response. And part of that response may need not be stated, because everyone knows the rule for preserving error in the improper admission of evidence is if you have a hearing outside the presence of the jury where you make your objection, there is no need to renew that objection when it is offered in the presence of the jury.
Because it's in the nature of a motion to suppress. But when you say no objection, where does that get you?
Well, that's what I'm not sure of, Judge, and that's what I need to, I'd like to take a look at, because, normally no objection
I would think that it could waive error. But I'm not sure in the context of, you know, an extensive hearing where there was an objection and a request that this piece of paper be redacted, whether or not, when it's offered in the presence of the jury, no objection.
So if the judge said, other than all the stuff you bored us with before, do you have any objection to this?
Yes.
Then they'd say, no, no objection.
Yes.
Then, okay.
I'm not sure if there's some magic language that that changes the waiver nature of the argument. So I would like to take a look at that and just submit maybe a case or two to the court. With respect to the last argument, Mr. Christian really is arguing, 10 years ago, check, bad act on the check. We're talking about murders 10 years later. Number one, you never know what it is the jury is going to latch on to determine their verdict. And yes, we've all lied, but it is the state here, and I quoted from the state's brief earlier, the state, even looking at the brief, has indicated this is a very important piece of evidence. They claim on page 14, because the check connected appellant to the murder. So what they were what they were trying to do is connect this check, and that was stressed as a reason in a circumstantial evidence case. There was no direct evidence at all that this check was very important. Now they're trying to say this check couldn't have been important because it was 10 years before. It did show a bad act. It did tend to show dishonesty on a fairly material issue in the case. So I think that we can't say that this error is harmless. So my time is about up.
We're not going to cut you off. So
the language that's on page 14 in the state's brief says, because the check connected appellant to the murder weapon. What it really means, what's really truthful about that in a more refined way, is that the check connected the appellant to the purchase of a .38 caliber, .357 caliber type, or that was the purchase of his .38 caliber Colt weapon, not the murder weapon, because the murder weapon was never found.
Yes.
So you can't connect. That check couldn't have connected him to any particular weapon except a .38 Colt revolver.
Yes. But, you know, I think there's a big difference. If I sell you a gun and I say, this is the weapon that killed Abraham Lincoln, you might think it's of historical importance and buy it. And then you find out, no, it's a type of gun that killed Lincoln. There is a big difference there. The state was trying to use that check to show, yes, show something that it had the right to show in a circumstantial evidence case, another weak piece of circumstantial evidence that they might build a mountain, and that mountain of circumstantial evidence might be enough to persuade the jury. But this was a critical link in building that mountain. And I think that there is a possibility that everyone must admit exists that the jury used that check and that notation on the check for a reason that it wasn't introduced. And that showed that he was a dishonest person. He lied about the purchase of the gun. He could be lying to the police when they interviewed him about his connection and his relationship with Ms. Richter. So I think we can't say that.
But I thought we'd already established basically what the state, as I understood, was saying. Look, we know that this was a murder committed by a .38 Colt or a .357 Magnum.
Yes.
Sir, have you ever owned such a gun? No. And then, well, in fact, you have owned such a gun. You lied about whether or not you've owned such a gun. Why would you lie about owning such a gun unless you committed the crime?
Yes.
Okay, so I thought that's what they were trying to say.
Yeah, it was.
Whether or not this check that established a lie had on it that it was for a door instead of a gun is sort of an aside. The real point was we established that you did, in fact, own a 38 when you told us you never did.
Yes.
I thought that's where they were going. But
that's where they did go. The problem is they then had a lie, you know, a double lie. One lie was proper, one lie wasn't. Okay. And all they had to do to solve this was agree to a redaction. And I know things happen very fast at trial, unbelievably fast. But this was a critical item of evidence. The defense counsel, trial counsel, proposed a reasonable solution to ending this problem. That is, just redact it. And the trial court said no. And I think the trial court, in saying no, ultimately requires this court to conclude, yes, there was an error. Yes, the potential for harm is great. And no, we don't have confidence that the jury's verdict was appropriate. So we would ask for, first of all, a reversal on the sufficiency point so as not allow retrial because of double jeopardy grounds. And in the event the court does not sustain point one, the abuse of discretion standard of points 2, 3, and 4 require a reversal and remand to the trial court for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. We appreciate your patience with our questions. As you can tell, we have lots of questions about this case, and although the briefing was quite good, and the briefing sometimes results in even more questions. So your case is submitted. You are finally free to go about your business if you dare go outside in this weather. And this court will finally be adjourned.